Good morning. I had forgotten that it was St. Patrick's Day until the Mullins walked in. And that was a lot of green, and all of a sudden I was like, whoops. It is my honor and privilege to be entrusted with bringing the word to us today. And so Rachel just prayed, so I'm going to go ahead and read our passage for us, and then we'll see what God has for us. Now among those who went up to worship at the feast were some Greeks. And so these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." And Philip went and told Andrew, and Andrew and Philip went and told Jesus. And Jesus answered them, "The hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. Truly, truly, I say to you, unless a grain of wheat falls into the earth and dies, it remains alone. But if it dies, it bears much fruit. Whoever loves his life loses it, and whoever hates his life in this world will keep it for eternal life. If anyone serves me, he must follow me, and where I am, there will my servant be also. If anyone serves me, the Father will honor him. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name." And then a voice came from heaven, "I have glorified it, and I will glorify it again." And the crowd that stood there and heard it said that it had thundered. And others said an angel had spoken to him. And Jesus answered, "This voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world, and now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." And he said this to show by what kind of death he was going to die. This is the word of the Lord. Now, as Rachel said, today is the fifth Sunday of Lent. And so if you were here last week, Mia Peterson preached to us from John chapter 3, where Nicodemus, a Pharisee, comes to Jesus in the night looking for answers. And this morning, the lectionary reading has us skipping ahead to John 12, where another group of people is wanting to speak to Jesus. And this time, it's the Greeks. And given where we are in the church calendar, it should really be no surprise to you that the context for this passage is that we are entering into the last days of Christ. It's nearly Passover, and the city of Jerusalem would have been packed out as people kind of traveled in from all around for this festival. And next week, we're going to commemorate Palm Sunday, where Jesus himself enters Jerusalem for a final time. But in our passage in John, that moment has actually already happened in the earlier part of chapter 12, and so we're maybe a couple of days past it. And it's really quite interesting because the whole book of John has at most an account of maybe 20 days from the life of Christ. And about a third of the book is devoted to a single day, the day before the crucifixion. And so there has to be something important enough about this day that John decides to mention it. And so in all these chapters that we skipped over between last week's passage and this one, Jesus has been saying, "My hour has not yet come. It's not time yet. It's not time yet." But now we have reached a turning point. And what we've been anticipating since almost the very beginning of John is now imminent. And so in harmony with the will of the Father, it is now time. And we know it with the benefit of 2,000 years and with written records of eyewitness testimony, but Jesus also knows it. And I want you to hold that in your mind because we'll circle back to it in a few minutes. But first, let's walk through the beginning of the passage. It says some Greeks who had come to Jerusalem for the Passover celebration paid a visit to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee. And they said, "Sir, we want to meet Jesus." And so Philip told Andrew about it, and then together they went to see Jesus and to ask him. So the first thing we're told is that we have these Greeks, and they are curious about Jesus. They've come to Jerusalem to celebrate the Passover, even though they are likely Gentiles. And while they're here, they approach one of the disciples, Philip, the only disciple who happens to have a name that is Greek. And they ask to see Jesus. And why might they do that? Now, I think we can assume that they've probably heard his reputation as a teacher, as a miracle worker. Maybe they heard about the resurrection of Lazarus. We don't know. But whatever they know about Jesus has made them want to know more. And one of the commentaries I was reading this week reminded me how Jesus has, just a few days prior, come zealously sweeping through the temple and throwing out the money changers and the traitors from the outer court in order to restore it to its divinely ordained purpose, to be a place of prayer. And the author of this commentary was kind of hypothesizing. He was like, did these Greeks recognize that that action was taken in the interest of Gentiles like themselves, who when they came to the city to worship would only have been able to do so in that very spot? Because remember, that outer court, that's the only place that those non-Jews, those Greeks, could have been allowed to be. And so Jesus has already made a way for them by restoring this place to its proper function. And regardless of whether they realize what he's already done for them or not, the Greeks come to Jesus, to Philip, asking to meet Jesus, and then the scene's going to cut. We're not going to really hear about them. Instead, Philip is going to go to Andrew, who's another disciple, also from the same place, from Bethsaida. And together, they're going to go to Jesus, presumably to ask if he's going to meet these visitors. And so what does Jesus say? Jesus replies, "Now the time has come for the Son of Man to enter into his glory." He says, "I tell you the truth, unless a kernel of wheat is planted in the soil and it dies, it remains alone. But in its death, it produces many new kernels, a plentiful harvest of new lives," the text says. It says, "Those who love their life in this world will lose it, and those who care nothing for this life in this world will keep it for eternity. And anyone who wants to serve me must follow me, because my servants must be where I am. And the Father will honor anyone who serves me." So Jesus says that it is now time for him to enter into his glory. It's time for who he really is to be put on display. No longer is he going to use this like veiled language, or if he's going to caution people about speaking about his identity. Jesus has reached a strategic turning point in his life, and how compelling that the sign we are given that his mission and his purpose is reaching its climax is the approach of these Gentiles. And we don't see Jesus respond to them here in this chapter, but we will, won't we? Because on the other side of the cross, Jesus becomes a savior to all, not just the Jews. And so these non-Jewish believers approaching him, they're representative of all Gentiles everywhere, and a sign that Jesus has concluded his mission to the Jews. So all this begs the question, what does this mean for Jesus to say that it's time for him to enter into his glory? We already know that Jesus is the manifestation of God's glory. And that can mean a lot of things, but I've been listening to a lot of Ashley Matthews, and I love how she sums it up. She says that Jesus is the manifestation of God's heart and God's capacity for love. So when we see Jesus loving people, we are seeing God's glory at work. And if Jesus is entering into his glory, he is entering into his love, because his glory is his love for us. And what is the greatest expression of love? John 15:13 says, "Greater love has no man than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends." So Jesus is speaking of the moment when he will be most glorified and most lifted up, which is, of course, the cross and his subsequent resurrection. So Jesus is willing to face death, even death on a cross, because of his glory and because of his love. Not one or the other, but both, because they are the same. Jesus is going to use this illustration about a seed and a harvest to demonstrate a seeming paradox, that the way to life is somehow inexplicably found through death. And I hear echoes of Nicodemus's question from last week. How can someone be born again even when they are old? And the gospel is full of mysteries such as these, right? These paradoxes that help us to explore the scope and the nuance of truth. That the greatest among you will be your servant, and that when I am weak, I am strong, and that we can have nothing and yet possess everything, and that when we die to ourselves, somehow we learn to truly live. So Jesus says that unless this seed is willing to sacrifice itself, then there is no harvest. But in its death, there is new life. And in the same way that this one seed going into the ground allows it to reproduce and create something that is far greater, so Jesus' death is necessary in order to produce something far greater than if he continued to live as one man on earth, even the greatest man in history. His death is necessary so that he might once and for all bring triumph out of tragedy and honor out of disgrace and lasting victory out of apparent defeat. And John wants us to see him for who he is, as the Son of God and as God himself, the God who has called us and who goes before us. Because as he goes to the cross, he asks us to go with him and to be where he is. And yes, Jesus is making a sacrifice that none of us could make. And he is making something permanent that we could never accomplish. But we are still invited to follow in his footsteps. Jesus says, anyone who wants to serve me must follow me because my servants must be where I am. And you know this. All of us who preach at this church have said it over and over, week after week, month after month. Part of why we have a preaching team is so that we can do that, that we all might say the same things again and again, and it might hit you a little bit differently because of who said it and how they said it and when they said it, and that today might be the day that you really hear it and you take it seriously. I grew up with this verse about a kernel of wheat having to be buried in order to produce a harvest painted on my wall, on a piece of art that my mom made out of old fence boards. And it was a reminder of the sacrifice that may be required of each of us to follow Jesus. And especially for my dad, who was and is a Muslim convert to Christianity, there are real life and death implications to that. And here's the reality. For most of us, we do not have to think about death all that much. I don't even mean death with a capital D, though that's certainly included. The science and technology of the 21st century in the Western world allow us to have a separation and a detachment from the very fragility of life that just wasn't possible in earlier parts of history. I've never had to kill my own dinner, though some of you may have voluntarily chosen to do so for reasons I will never understand. I don't even have to deal with the consequences of, like, a bad crop. I can go to the grocery store at any time of year and expect to find strawberries and grapes and oranges available to me. When our kids are sick, we go get an antibiotic. When we aren't sure how we're going to make ends meet, there's still resources available to us. And even when we or the people that we love are actually dying, it's very often happening in a seemingly controlled, sterile environment. Now, obviously, I'm not saying that we don't experience the anguish of death around us or grieve its consequences. Devastating tragedy and abuse happen every day. And if you know me at all, you know how much I care that you have a witness to whatever you are experiencing. It's a skill that I hope will someday make me a good therapist. But as much, so much about progress is about removing ourselves as far as possible from the fact that we are mortal and finite and limited. And so much so that when Christ bids us to come and die, it is foreign to us because we spend so much time and so many resources trying to forget that our earthly lives are going to end. And instead of looking ahead to that inevitability, we cling to what we have now with a white-knuckle grip. But Jesus invites us to feel the finiteness that it is to be human. And that's uncomfortable. That makes sense. because we've been conditioned to ignore our limitedness and to deny our lack of control in all of the ways that we possibly can. But Jesus says that if you try and hold on to this temporal life, prioritizing and caring about it more than your eternal one, you will actually walk away with nothing. And by holding on to this life so tightly, we actually die a million tiny deaths as things slip from our grasp time and time again. Now, I do think that there's some hyperbole in these verses. When we read about loving our life and hating our life, I don't think John is saying that we are actually to care nothing about our life, about our families, or about anything outside of God. No, God has created a lavish, colorful, beautiful, abundant world that is meant to be enjoyed to the max. We talk about that so often in this space. We are a feasting people who take pleasure in good wine and good food and good company. We live in awe of how God has given us not just the bare necessities, but the whole garden. And there's boundaries, don't touch that one tree. But this whole place is for us. And would we love God so much that by comparison, it would seem as though we hated everything else? So yes, there's some hyperbole. But do not be mistaken. There is a very real directive here. To be a servant of Christ is to go where Jesus goes. And it is for our sanctification that that is the case. You know, Jonathan talked a couple of weeks ago about how easy it is for teachers and preachers to get all analytical and explanatory, and how at times that can mean that we sometimes miss entering into the story and actually just sitting with it and listening to it and wrestling with it. And I think that he's right, and I'm certainly guilty of that. And I think for some people that's a struggle because they're super smart and they just have all these insights into the text. But you know what? I think that it's also difficult because it can just be kind of scary to sit there and to let the word of God really work on you personally. Because you don't really know where you're going to end up if you do that. And I think it's a pretty well-supported guess to say that wherever that is might not be comfortable. I think that there's a reason that this book is depicted as a sword. Hebrews 4 describes it as piercing the division of soul and spirit, of joints and marrow, and discerning and judging the thoughts and intentions of the heart. So not unsurprisingly, the temptation would be to not let it get quite close enough to do that. But there's something about this text that won't let us get away with that. There's something gritty and fervent here, and I don't want us to miss that. So let's take a minute and let's sit with this text. Let's let it grab us and hold on a little bit. Jesus says, "Now my soul is deeply troubled. Should I pray, Father, save me from this hour? But this is the very reason I came. Father, bring glory to your name." Jesus gives us a little bit of insight into the inner consciousness of Jesus. Jesus knows that the end is coming. And I'm not sure in what detail he knows that this mystery of being fully God and fully human, like that eludes us all. But he knows that he is going to die. And he knows that it's going to be brutal and violent. And it makes the fact that he's sweating blood later in the garden just have a little bit more weight. He's human. And for most of us, unless there's some kind of other psychopathology going on, our sense of self-preservation is natural and it is deep. There's an innate drive in us to avoid danger and avoid pain. And Jesus is thinking of the agony of the cross just a few days away. And he says that his soul is deeply troubled over it. And yet he looks at his alternate option to ask his Father to save him from this hour, and he refuses to pray it. And reading this, I think to myself, thanks be to God that I do not know the future. Because if I knew the details of even just the everyday pain and suffering that I will have to walk through, I don't think that I would have the strength to walk into it anyway. I don't think that's a strength I possess. Not on my best days, and certainly not on my worst. But Jesus, knowing that far, far worse than everyday pain and suffering is ahead of him, He walks into it for you. And John, more than any of the other gospel writers, he wants us to see Jesus as sovereign over his own destiny, and that it is him who is now setting the course of the final events of his life in motion. He chooses this, and no one forces his hand and makes him do it, not even the Father. Not that the Father couldn't do it, but that he doesn't. Let's talk about this last section briefly, and then we're going to tie all this to Lent. And these final verses could probably be a whole other sermon that goes in a whole different direction, so we're just going to hit the high points. There's this voice from heaven, and he says, I have already brought glory to my name, and I will do so again. And the crowd hears his voice, and some thought it was thunder, and some thought it was an angel that had spoken to him. And then Jesus told them, the voice was for your benefit, not mine. The time for judging this world has come, when Satan, the ruler of the world, will be cast out. And when I am lifted up from the earth, I will draw everyone to myself. And he said this to indicate how he was going to die. So we hear a voice from heaven testify to the Son. And this is the third affirmation of Jesus' status as the Son of God that we get from the Father. The first, if you'll remember, was at Jesus' baptism, and the second was at the Transfiguration. And the response to this divine voice is mixed. Some people think it's just thunder, and some other people think that it was an angel, and generally people are just confused, even though we're told that this voice is for their benefit. They are deaf, as we are so often deaf, to the reality that God has been made manifest before them, not only as a voice from heaven, but as a man in their midst. And Jesus says, not only has the time for his death come, but also the time for judging this world and its ruler. And he claims a decisive victory. He says Satan will be cast out, and that when he is lifted up, he's going to draw the whole world to himself. So let's connect all of this to Lent. In the practices of Lent, we exercise self-discipline and we bound ourselves and our appetites. We embody our own finiteness. And of our own free will, we enter into the wilderness and we choose to sacrifice what is good for the sake of what is best for our souls. And Lent is not the time for temporarily fasting from the not-so-good things that we do or we desire. Those things are just sin, and we're supposed to give them up permanently. We're supposed to fast them and never bring them back, right? Instead, we give up good things to remind ourselves that we follow a God who is even better, and we want to make space to see him more clearly so that we will be moved in our souls to follow him even unto death. I met with Kyle before Lent started, to chat about all of this, and it gave me the opportunity to be really intentional about both what I'm abstaining from and from the disciplines that I felt like God was asking me to commit myself to. And to be transparent with you, I have fallen on my face at every turn. But Lent is not a test of my endurance. God already knows every single one of my weaknesses and my sins. And I am invited into this, not so that I might build up my willpower, but so that I might be reminded that I am mortal, and that I have a soul, and that my soul can be strengthened through the practices of this season. And so even though it would seem as though I am failing to do this well, there is still something sacred happening in me regardless. Here's what I can tell you so far. In the practice of saying no to myself over the last few weeks, I'm learning three things. First, it is not until we start to deny ourselves that we truly see the selfishness and the darkness within us. It is in this place that I start to see where my appetites have crept outside of their proper boundaries, where I have taken what is good and I have twisted it into something that is slowly bringing me death, not life. Second, as I say no to myself, I am realizing that often, surprise, surprise, what I actually have is already enough. And it is not that I no longer want those other things. I still want them. But at the very least, I am learning to wait for them, to delay gratification and the dopamine hit that comes from getting what I want when I want it. And in doing so, I am seeing that God can sustain me with what I already have. But thirdly, and this is what I want you to hear most, I am learning that having enough is not the promise. Having enough is not the promise. The promise is that God will be with me, both in times of plenty and in times of need. That the time is going to come when you won't have enough. There's going to be days when the headache that I have, the headache that you have, is a direct result of the fact that you are fasting, and so your blood sugar is dropping. And so the fact that you overreacted at the kids and then were cross with your spouse is exactly because you do not have enough. And this is the crucial question. What are you going to do then? Because when I look back at 2023, there are some clear areas of my life where I do not have enough. And I have made it to today, but I don't yet know if I can look into the future and say that I'm always going to be okay, even if God never shows up in those areas. So the question I'm wrestling with, and what I want and ask you to sit with, is will you still hold on to the belief that God is faithful and good and that he is enough even when you do not have enough? And so we practice with these little things during Lent. We name our finiteness and we face our mortality in these small ways, in fasting and giving up sweets and social media and getting up earlier. We do these things so that when the truly hellish things come along, death in whatever form, of dreams, of reputations, of loved ones, jobs, homes, health, unforeseen and unanticipated and not what we bargained for at all, when these things happen, and they will we have developed the spiritual muscles we need to stay in the game? So that we too might echo Jesus' words, "Father, bring glory to your name." Because this is not a trial run. We do not get to return this version of our life for a different model where we are better or stronger or less busy and more in control, where the people that we love do not die, where we can hit the brakes a second sooner. No, this is the game, and this is where worship and devotion begins. So what is Lent for? It is a reminder that we are invited into the same life that Jesus lives, to the wilderness and to sacrifice. And this is a chance to take inventory of ourselves and our souls. The question is not, and it never has been, will you love me when times are good? When the evidence of your kindness and your faithfulness is spread out before me, faith is grown in the dark. It is what we do when we cannot see that demonstrates who we really are. And all of God's servants must take this detour through the valley of the shadow of death, that in that time, we choose. Are we going to lament in God's direction, or are we going to choose to walk away? And Mosaic, we have to stare this thing down, our fear and our doubt and our mistrust that God is faithful when we lose sight of him. One, because our lack of ability to see the evidence of his continued goodness doesn't mean that it isn't there. But two, because if we do not stare it down, it means that we are destined to repeat the story of the garden forever. That whenever it seems as though God is not for me, I'm going to backtrack and I'm going to go my own way. I'm going to do my own thing. And hopefully, at some point, I'll realize I'm actually wrong and that God is faithful after all. And so I'll return and the cycle's going to start over. But no. No, that's not our only option. The same spirit that raised Jesus from the dead lives in you. And you are empowered by that spirit to face death and to know that your soul, to know in your soul that somehow God is still here and he is still faithful and he's still good. And that this is a temporary burial so that the next harvest can grow. Jesus has already cleared out the temple courts for you. He has gone ahead of you into the wilderness. He has claimed victory over your tormentor, and he is drawing you now to himself. I think that most of you already know this, but I'm moving out of state at the beginning of May. And so this is my last time to get to do this like this as family. And so there's an opportunity here for me to give you a charge. And Kyle and Jonathan and Rachel and Mia and Grant and Wes, whatever they call us to, whatever standard they set, they have to live it out in front of you all. And that's a lot of pressure. And I have to live up to that standard too, but I'm going to get to do it from a little bit of a distance, since that gives me a little bit of freedom to say some things. So what I want to charge you with is this. While I might not know the details of your life right now, whether these are your very best, most triumphant days, or whether this is a season of grief and anguish that feels like a bottomless lake, and you can't decide if you're going to fight for the surface or you're just going to let yourself sink. Regardless, what I know, what I am confident in, is that this season is not the exception to the promise. God is with you here as he has always been. And you have both an invitation and a responsibility to devote yourself to him now, in this, in dating, in parenthood, in college, in the middle of your career, in retirement, in marriage, in job hunting, in singleness, in whatever this season looks like. There's not a formula for what faithfulness looks like. To be a Christian is to serve and follow Jesus. And we don't stop doing our jobs and caring for our families and studying at school to do that. We do these things as servants and followers of Jesus, but you know when you're not doing it. So do not deceive yourselves. It will always seem as though in the next season, you will have more time and more energy and more resources to devote to the things of God. And then you will blink and you will be in your own last days. So do not wait. The invitation is not for us to return to God on our own terms, but on his. And this book is clear. You will reap what you sow. And if you continually sow to the Spirit, eventually you will reap life. And the opposite is also true. So choose wisely. There is no time to lose. Lay hold of your life in such a way that it becomes a place for the Spirit of God to fill. Devotion is about the attention that we give to God. It is not emotion, but it does lead to a sensitivity of feeling. It is about the rhythms and the moments in our days, and intimacy grows in proportion to your obedience. So play this long game of faithfulness. Strawn Coleman, who runs the social media account Commoners Communion on Instagram, he writes, "What our habits will do is day after day, year on year, they will build a place for God to meet with us in the times and the ways that he longs to, helping us see a little clearer whether our dry seasons are self-inflicted or God-driven." So our habits become these altars of availability, and God does the rest. So take advantage of Lent. Learn to suffer well in a way that produces perseverance and character and hope. And participate in the disciplines of faith that grow your sensitivity to the Spirit and the voice of God, so that you will be able to discern it, even in the hard times, especially in the hard times. And know that you are not alone. I'm cheering you on, and I believe in you, and I'm so honored to have been a small part of such a beautiful and meaningful community. And so as the band comes back up and we transition into communion, I think this might just be a moment to sit with this overwhelming, arresting truth, that when Jesus looks at you, he sees everything about you, all of your days spread out before him. He sees your favorite qualities about yourself, and he sees the things that you hope that no one ever finds out about. He sees you at your brightest when you're brave and you try something new, and he sees you at your most vulnerable when you're tangled up in your anxiety and you're wondering if you just messed something up with someone beyond repair. He sees every win and every loss, every victory and every sin, and he chooses it all. He chooses you, as you are. And as he knows you could be, and as you will be someday. And for you, he looks at the cross and he says, I'll do it. You are the reason that I came. And so may we respond to that kind of love with humble repentance. May we honestly inventory ourselves and confess where our appetites have gotten out of hand. And may today be the day that we return to the Lord and begin to love him with renewed devotion, with all our hearts and with all our souls and with all our minds. Because Easter is coming and blessed are those who believe. Let me pray. Spirit of God, just such a humble thing to know that you saw me in all of my sin and all of my failings. And somehow you saw that saving me was your glory. And you did it out of love. And so I thank you for that. And for each of us in here, God, would you just stir something up in our hearts to pursue you and to be transformed by you, and that that love would be so apparent and that everything else, it would seem as though we hated everything else in comparison, God. You're so good to us, and you're faithful even when we cannot see it. And so would you come, and would you move in us? The band is going to play a song, and while they're doing that, if it's day 100 or day 10,000, you're invited to come up here and to take a piece of the bread that represents the body of Christ and the cup that represents the life poured out for you. Now hold on to those elements and then go back to your seat. And I'll come back up after the band finishes and lead us in the taking of communion together.